So, think about this. How did you get to be you? How did you develop the beliefs you possess and the way of looking at the world that you have? Why do you have the goals that you pursue? And what happens when those goals don't lead to what you thought they would lead to? What do you do when the beliefs you've always held seem inadequate to deal with life or to explain the reality that you are seeing every day? Or when you see that those beliefs may have had a destructive effect on your soul or on the lives of the people around you. Good morning, Erie, Pennsylvania. I am Chuck Camerata, and this is Next 2.0 with Marcus Atkinson, who is not with us today. But the person who is with me today has been thinking about the questions I just mentioned for a long time. His name is James Allison, who I met at a conference in Asheville, North Carolina a couple months ago. James is an English Catholic priest and theologian. He studied Spanish and history at Oxford, also studied at Jesuit College in Brazil. He has an extensive background in ministry and service and justice work. He has lived in Central America, South America, the UK, the US, and now resides in Madrid, Spain, and has written a bunch of books, my favorite of which is The Joy of Being Wrong, which is kind of dear to my heart. In a moment, we will zoom in with James, who is, in fact, in Madrid today. But first, the obligatory promotional information you need to know. This is Next 2.0, and Next 2.0 is a program of WQLN NPR. Next is produced by the Public's Voice Media. If you want to know more about Next 2.0, you can go to Facebook and like our page, or Instagram and follow Next 2.0 Erie, where you can keep up with upcoming show promos, events, and clips about what's next for our community and our democracy. Now, here is my interview with James Allison.
So how are you, James?
I'm very well, thank you.
How's the view in... from Madrid?
Well, it's a nice bright afternoon, and after a very rainy Holy Week,
Really?
Cold and rainy, things have gradually warmed and brightened up.
Cool. So it's kind of springtime there.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what really interests me about you. So the two things that turned me on to the possibility of talking to you in this format. Mm-hmm. One was the description of you that was in the Porch Gathering brochure that came out in months ago. And it talked about that you thinking about and talking about the ways that we develop our stories and come to understand ourselves in the world. And then when I came to the conference and you talked about mimesis and the work that Rene Girard did, about how we define ourselves. I'm really fascinated by that question because I think our sense of identities is behind, and this is just me, but is behind a lot of the struggles and the conflicts that we have in our world today, because your identity oftentimes is defined over against my identity. And I find that that leads to argument and on the low end, and to terrible violence on the more extreme end. So I wanted to talk to you about culturally how we develop our worldviews, and then maybe think a little bit about how that feeds into the conflicts and divisions that are so much more prominent today, or at least I'm more aware of them today than 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. So the stuff that's going on in our world feels to me something like a battle of worldviews. Is that an approach or a thought that makes some sense to you?
Not really. It seems okay to me that prioritizes the product over what is producing it. That suggests that essentially it's things which are in our head rather than the relationships between us, which throw up things in our head, which then acquire a life of their own and feed back into the relationships. But I think that it's the how we are together that runs these things. And yeah, this is one of my, I derived this from Girard, of course, since I don't have any original ideas of my own, but it's the notion that relationality is prior to rationality. It's the other is prior to the thinking self. And according as the relationship with what is other is hostile, so I will be formed in hostility. According as it is peaceful, and usually it's a mixture of both, I will be formed pacifically and stably. And usually the question for all of us is how to find our way into letting go of that which is hostile and accepting that which is loving and constructive, and then beginning to understand our reality in that way, you know, filtering through those things. But that usually takes a long, long time, because many of us indeed find ourselves triggered into accepting being who we are as part of the hostility, and then doubling down against it, because it's the only way we have an identity. You know, if I give up being against X, then who will I be?
So whole cultures get formed around who's my enemy.
Yes, and the current members of our culture, in meaning us, are not necessarily aware of how much they owe to that enemy making of the past, because it has become co-natural to them. I think that's one of the things which your country and my country are seeing with relation to the consequences of the North Atlantic slave trade. To what extent both our cultures have been completely built over against what in fact was terribly violent, hateful and sinful depredations of part of the human race. And yet we find it terribly difficult to admit quite to what an extent that colors our whole way of relating in our societies.
Not just to admit it, even to see it.
And then, so that leads, you know, it's not the kind of thing that could be sorted out by a quick argument. It's the kind of thing that requires a generation to be able to work through thinking, oh my God, we're beginning to see quite how awful that was. Let us see if we can find a way to make a new we that is in some way reconciled and in some way truthful. And I think that that's true of so many different levels of society. But unfortunately, it's much, much easier for people to double down into other little excuses like freedom or white supremacy or Christian nationalism or whatever. I mean, all of which are reactive against having to deal with the elephant in the room. So, yeah, I think that's an example of how something big that happened relationally is quietly driving the ideas in a reactive way.
So we've got to
emerge from it. And that, incidentally, because there's a, you know, there's a similar danger, which is that the people who've got it right, and that means very often African Americans or people of African origin in other Western countries, who have, if you like, all the right to be righteous about that, can, and one understands absolutely right, become extremely angry and critical, though the best of them realize that we need help in being forgiven, a help that we never gave them. But it does mean that some, at least, enter into what you know, self-righteous arguments of accusation, which, of course, immediately produce a doubling down. And that means, you know, there's a cancel culture and things like that you get, which is just as binary in its thinking, if you like, as the doubling down. And that's a splendid way of getting nowhere at all.
That's exactly right. And we're proving that, aren't we?
And we're proving that.
So I think of people like Desmond Tutu and Mandela and MLK, people who are saying that there has to be a better way, a different way, and offering some thoughts about the way forward, that it's not about violence, that it's not about winning. It's about, what is it about?
Well, I think in this case, it's about being forgiven. And that means listening and undergoing breaking of heart. And I think that therefore the principal speakers in this sphere are precisely going to be people like Martin Luther King and Desmond Tutu and Mandela, people who are able to tell the truth from a non-resentful but a firm position.
Yeah.
Where they say, no, isn't there something true here?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to exercise that truth in an accusatory way, but for those who want to be forgiven, this is the way we go. So, I mean, it means that those of us who are used to being the dominating voices, we have to become listening voices.
Yeah. And if you're
and if you're dominant, that's a very difficult thing to do.
Yep.
Because you're used to being the person. You're used to being the person who gets to write the New York Times opinion piece, and therefore are completely unaware of to what extent you are run by them. No, so I think this is a very slow process. It requires slow thinking.
Yeah. But then, one of the things I talk to about to people with or about is this issue of yes, but. So it is, I've come to recognize that it's a long, slow process, but there are also things that have to be dealt with immediately. And so there's kind of a macro and a micro, a short term and a long term. We can't allow the continued oppression or violence to be aimed at marginalized groups, but just stopping that legislatively or however doesn't get us past the problems. So we have to be doing two things, working on the short term, the prevention of violence done to people, and the longer term, which is opening people's hearts to one another, reconfiguring or rethinking the relationships that lead us to develop a sense of identity.
Yeah, I hope so. I would emphasize the slow part first.
So how do you do that? As you think about that, what are some of the things that you think might contribute to moving slowly in the direction of redefining our relationships or rethinking them?
Well, my experience and work in this field has been that of attempting to be a truthful gay man in the Catholic Church. So the arguments are slightly different. Slightly different, but it's essentially the same thing. Basically, it means being prepared to be a non-person in your own setting for a long, long time, on the grounds that you hold the hope and the truth, the hope that God will bring the truth to light, and that you will have been found at your post in standing up for that, even if it hasn't got you any recognition or appreciation. But eventually, that's how slow thinking works. Slow thinking is not simply people thinking slowly. It's people being in a place where the witness to truthfulness is lived slowly, so that eventually it can be perceived. At first, it can't be. But that's just my take in a tiny little bit of this, in a much smaller issue than the one we were talking about there. That effects on both sides of the Atlantic of the North Atlantic or the Atlantic slave trade.
Yeah.
Since it's just the same thing in Brazil as well.
Oh yeah, where you lived for a while.
For a while, and I have a son who is Afro-Brazilian. Yeah, no, it's something that I feel very, very passionate about.
So you and I are in terms of probably the way we think about these things, we probably have similar ways of thinking about them. But I'm a straight middle class white American, and you're a gay Brit and world traveler, and so I'm coming from a position of absolute and utter privilege. I think
I should say,
in some ways, but you're also
in most ways.
Okay.
I mean, for instance, you and I have in common that we are white, cis, men, which means automatically A, with relationship to women, and B, with relation to trans people. We have a huge number amount of built-in privilege. And so, yes, we have much more in common than we have apart. And it's always worth remembering similarity rather than difference. So I'm well aware that voices like mine are not necessarily very important any longer. And the importance of finding the people who are able to speak out of the places that are just being discovered as being, that are just being discovered as being truth bearing. Those are the interesting ones.
Yeah. Boy, it's hard to be one of those voices.
Yes, which is why if one can find them, hold them.
Scary place for many people to be. We have we have a burgeoning, not burgeoning, that's not the right word. We have a cohort, a demographic that's gathering steam in our area in terms of being seen and being vocal, that is the LGBT community. And I've gotten involved in it a little bit. I have family members who are part of that. And it's been fascinating to watch the young, especially young Black gay women, young Black trans people, and the courage that it takes for them to step up and speak, but they're doing it here in our town anyway. And I think people are increasingly willing to listen, but it just feels to me like we have so far to go. And I'm not a patient person, so I want to...
I'm not a patient person either. And it is one of the... It is one of the difficult things. I mean, you know, your culture, even more than my culture, North America is a strange mixture of evangelical Protestantism and Enlightenmentism, which means that there's a certain verbal self-righteousness that is constantly asserting itself, us explaining to ourselves and setting ourselves as the innocent ones. We're the good guys. And ultimately, that's only verbal. It really does take, I think, quite a long time before that moves from the sphere of people who can say things in public and America can hear them for a bit. But the real changes are economic. I think, I mean, that's the thing. If everybody becomes someone who's able to get their 15 minutes of fame, but ultimately you have a neoliberal system that is driving people into ever greater dependence on an ever smaller safety net, then, and of course, the people who will suffer most from that are precisely Black people and Black women, and even more terribly, Black trans persons. So, I mean, I think that those are the things. How, just from my position as a Catholic priest and theologian, how to Catholicize some of the Calvin and Hobbes world of the United States, because Calvin and Hobbes it is.
Yeah, it is one of my favorite comics, by the way. In addition to understanding what generates it.
You know, you could do a little bit more with Aquinas and Marx. That would be a good comic to have.
That would be a great class for in seminary or graduate school, the theology or philosophy of Calvin and Hobbes. And
I'm sure that it's being done frequently.
That's just brilliant stuff. It leads me to thinking a little bit about one of the other things that you talked about at the conference. I'm always trying to find get to the root cause of things, and I guess in my little head, I think if we can find the root, we can just fix that thing, and that's kind of where I come from. I know it's much more complicated than that, but I'd like to think that. Yep. But one of the things you talked about in Asheville was rethinking to a certain degree the story or the theology that's been a big part of Western Christianity for millennia, the story that frames God as a kind of overbearing and ever-present judge watching for our mistakes. I think Gareth Higgins wrote something recently about God, the monster in the sky, the kind of bully who needs to be appeased. Hence Jesus as our substitutionary sacrifice to assuage God's wrath so that we don't have to experience it. But you talked about kind of leaving that story behind with all of its destructive consequences and maybe embracing a view of God that sees Jesus as something more like the embodiment of, the incarnation of, a kind of love that is beyond us in many ways, that is overwhelmingly beautiful and powerful. It's a story that understands Jesus as corrective to the legalistic and appeasement kind of approach to Christian theology. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit more about that. The switch in, or not the switch, but a change in emphasis in the way that we see the work that Jesus did. And am I right about that in my assessment of what you were teaching?
Somewhat. You emphasize it as if it's a change of idea. I would again say, no, it's much, much more. It's much more basic than that. It's beginning to understand more deeply the happening that Jesus did in fact produce, and realize quite how inadequate and actually dangerous the version of it we have been telling ourselves has been, and beginning to understand quite how much that has locked us into a phony conservatism, a phony moralism, and a way of avoiding taking responsibility for our own living of Christianity by making the key thing about it a backroom deal between Jesus paying the price to the Father to assuage his wrath. But so, in a sense, what I'm trying to bring out is something which curiously is much more conservative and ancient in its reading of the text, which presupposes it's exactly the same text as we have and which we tend to misread, because once you give people a mental framework, they will then read everything within that framework.
Exactly.
This is the understanding that at the center of this has always been, from the beginning, God, without any violence at all, coming into the world to occupy the place into which we put, typically, our enemies, our people who can be discarded, because so to help us to create unity and thus safety together. And that this is our problem. In other words, that there is a violent divinity, and it's us. God, as it happens, has got no part in it. The only incident we have with relation to God from it is God trying to come into the midst of it, and actually succeeding in coming into the midst of it, so as to open up to us what is in fact going on, what we're in fact doing, and to make it clear that he doesn't hold this against us, but wants to offer us the way out of being run by what is essentially an idolatrous system, which we convince ourselves is natural, and instead to start creating the unity of humans as collaborators and sharers in a much greater life, and a sharing in the life of God. So it puts the violence where it is, which is our violence, and shows how the violence works, and makes it possible for us to be forgiven. It shows how forgiveness works. Now that is a completely different picture of exactly the same facts.
The framework
is entirely different. But once you see that, you can begin to see how, in fact, Christianity works. It works by making visible ways, how our ways of ganging up over against wicked others are, in fact, repetitions of the sacrifice of Jesus and are precisely exactly that from which we need to be forgiven. So it's, oh my God, we're doing it again. Which means that we can start to learn from those on our borders. If like the wicked other, whoever the wicked other du jour is.
Yeah, du jour, yeah.
Which means that there's a constant learning process going on as we expand into Catholicity. Catholicity meaning not over against anyone at all.
Yeah.
And that's an essential note of Christianity, not simply a description of the Catholic Church. It's an essential note of Christianity, the way in which we overcome sectarianism. And I think that that's, it shows how Christianity opens up a learning process rather than showing how Christianity locks people into a sacred box of fake goodness in which they must then hold on to irrational moral commandments and must be protected from learning anything real about the rest of the world because it might undo their sacred bubble and then hope that they die on the inside of this so they go to heaven. You think, no, okay, that is a salvation cult. That is not Christianity.
Yeah. If you use the framework that you're describing to read the Gospels, it's a powerful way, powerful lens through which to read.
Absolutely.
So Pharisees saying that Jesus has to go, one man should die for the sake of. It's
actually Caiaphas, not the Pharisees, that was Caiaphas. High priest.
It looks to me like in the framework that we're talking about here, that the Pharisees become a kind of an exemplar of that superficial kind of faith that you were talking about, living inside this particular bubble.
I assume that the place of the Pharisees in the gospel accounts are to make us aware of how all our clerical institutions work.
Absolutely.
That it's nothing to do with the Pharisees, qua Pharisees. It's to do with how all our pastors and priests and cardinals and bishops are inclined to run the show and quite what something different is being done in our midst by the one who technically they are working for. We are working for. But I think that's hugely important, or else one, it's very easy to slip into some or other form of anti-Semitism. I think, no, okay, this is very grosso modo, but translated into modern terms, basically think of the Pharisees as pastors, and the priests and high priests and scribes as the Catholic priests and cardinals, and the Sanhedrin and the whatchamacallit, the Sadducees as the rich oligarchs who pay for the whole thing. This is our world.
Yeah, it is.
And the same we need to be wrestling with constantly. It's not a they.
And that's kind of, I really like that because it casts Jesus in a role that's about bringing all of these people to see.
Yes.
And where they are in that process.
And indeed, and to see that they have a role in that process if they can be turned.
Yeah.
If we can be turned.
So what do you make of some of the things that are going on? And I guess what's happening in America with our elections and the really genuine craziness that is surrounding the cult of Donald Trump, who is now kind of casting himself as a Jesus figure. And many people in the evangelical churches here are buying that and celebrating that. What do you make of the American church pointing to Donald Trump as a kind of messianic figure?
Well, one, it seems to be the inevitable consequence of 40 years of neoliberalism linked with Christian moralism. I mean, basically, this is the logical conclusion of the path down which you got set in the reaction to Jimmy Carter. and in the reaction to not only to Jimmy Carter, but I think to the movement to desegregate schools and universities in the state. Remember that the moral majority was born not to fight against abortion, but to fight against tax, federal funding being withheld from segregated schools. Yeah. And the adoption of abortion as the key policy was a bit of a ruse to try and keep people online on the grounds they realized it would not be popular.
Yeah. So you can't, at that time, you couldn't say we're doing this because we want to keep black people in their place.
Exactly. Whereas at the time, the Southern Baptists accepted Roe versus Wade as being perfectly sensible. It was basically, being upset about abortion was very much a Catholic thing, not a Protestant thing.
Yeah.
So that's, these were conscious political Caesaro-papal choices made.
Absolutely.
Both on the economic and on the religious front. And it seems to me that ultimately that should have so separated Christianity from Jesus and Jesus' teachings that the notion of Trump playing the victim by casting himself as Jesus should become plausible. Doesn't seem all that far from the thing. But now, I think I should say, I hope I'm right in this. I detected, and I was in my last visit to the States, I was there for 5 weeks and obviously chatted with lots of people and listened to lots of different things. I detected what I hope is something growing, which was what I would call rile fatigue. Ever since Trump stepped on the scene 10 years ago, the whole basis of his support and electioneering has depended on people getting riled up and doubling down on people getting riled up and then doubling down again on people getting riled up. And frankly, and that there was at least initially a certain sort of excitement in getting riled up, and indeed the excitement can be on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
But I got the sense that rile fatigue is setting in, that a huge number of people, perhaps even more on the center right, which is really what matters, because what you have lacked for the last 10 years has been a democratic center right party. But that a huge number of people are suffering from rile fatigue.
Yeah.
In other words, oh, for God's sake, can't we get this election out of the way so that this guy goes off the scene forever, and then we can perhaps start to have normal conversations again.
Yeah.
So I hope that's true. And I also think, again, this is just something I've detected, that as he gets more deranged, more desperate, more frightened, more obviously ill, mentally ill, no doubt physically as well, in ways that we aren't allowed to see.
Yeah.
That what used to have a glitter about it. It was an idol, but it had a certain glitter about it, coming down the gold staircase and all of that. And, it's just become scuzzy.
Mm. Yeah, I think he's Americans have begun to see it for what it is.
Exactly.
He's
not only a huckster, but there are clever and charming hucksters. in fact, there are clever and charming hucksters whom you forgive because they're so clever and charming. And you don't mind being fooled by them because they were such, there was just something actually basically fun about them.
That ain't
Trump. He used to have an entertaining value. And I think that as his little world gets smaller and smaller and smaller, he's lost the capacity to entertain. But B, basically, he's scuzzy. Everything about him is scuzzy. His financing is scuzzy. His marriage is scuzzy. His failed, his businesses with escorts is scuzzy. Literally everything about him is scuzzy.
Yep. Yep.
And I think that ultimately the choice is old but basically decent and fast degenerating and basically scuzzy.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that it's a great It's a great selling point.
It's nice to hear you talk about that as a more objective viewer of American society.
Well, I hope I'm. I'm a reader of a certain part of American society. Obviously, I have confirmation bias as well, sure, like everybody. But I did get the sense that the old deep, nasty, hateful melody that accompanied Trump is beginning to sound kitsch.
That your illustration at Ashfield about the differences in Wagner and Rossini and their music was, I think, inspired. I think that's a part of what's happening in America today. You're right. There is a certain bubble of energy that comes, a little inspiration that comes from Wagner's music. But it gets old. You just can't sustain that. I know some people in my sphere who continue to be able to operate in that level of anger. But so many of the folks that I know and talk to are just exhausted by it all. And so I see, and I probably run in circles similar to those that you do when you're in the States, but I see that in the people that I work with and know. There's still those who are angry and are going to stay that way. They get, like Donald Trump, they get energized by conflict and putting other people down and winning the battles against everybody else. But most of us don't. And we're seeing now people are beginning to say enough.
It wasn't a very high when it happened. And ultimately it is exhausting.
Yeah, I agree.
I think that part of the difficulty is going to be how to help those people who are still on the high get off it as their idol crumbles. Because, you know, yeah. I'm still not sure personally, and I say this, but, you know, I'm still not sure personally whether he will still be the Republican candidate in November.
Hmm. Well, I hope you're right about that.
Well, I don't know. I just don't know how, because I mean, obviously, he's the nominee in terms of having the votes at the moment. But I wonder whether a mixture of his own declining health and his probable criminal status by that time won't make it terribly difficult for the Republican Party not to try and come up with somebody.
Yeah.
Even if only to save some of their down ballot tickets, because of the fact is that Trump is going to occupy all the money and all the air. Yes. And if you're a Republican senator or congressional candidate, you must be in despair.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder how we give. I don't see it myself, but I'm not as astute about these kinds of things as other folks are. I don't see the off-ramp for those really angry Trump supporters. And the only ramp that I can see is that they will resort to violence as opposed to some way of reconciling themselves to, hopefully, to Trump's demise. But that is not something I'm personally capable of sorting out.
And I agree. I think there's the question of how do we let people off shame?
Yeah.
Because I think that at the basis of that is shame.
I agree. I think
that all the doubling downs are different forms of refusal to face up to shame. And I think that one of the most vital and important things that we as Christians can be or should be doing is making it possible for people not to be triggered by shame. Enable them to hold their shame gracefully.
Do you know much
that's
about...
Possible, that's only possible if we can hold our shame gracefully.
Yeah. Do you know much about the Truth and Reconciliation movement in South Africa, which strikes me as being something like or a kind of model for a way forward?
Yes, obviously it was able to happen. I mean, I don't know much about how it's going now. I remember it from the time when it came to being. It was much, much talked about. But in a sense, the US is talking about something very different to a particular, I mean, there was a particular set of circumstances in the last 10 years of apartheid, and an apartheid that had been formally put into place, I think I'm right in saying, since the 1940s. So it didn't last anything like as long.
Yeah.
I think that what a Truth and Reconciliation Committee would look like in the US would be immensely difficult, because it would undo the whole of the mythology of your history. It would involve the recognition that essentially what happened was, I'm throwing this out there, I'm not a historian, but from what I'm seeing, essentially the British Empire divided into two. It wasn't that you became free from the British Empire, the British Empire divided in two.
Yeah.
And one of the issues it divided over was the legitimacy of slavery and the landowners for whose they wanted slavery, and they pushed to dealing with the matter until the middle of the next century, and it still hasn't been
absolutely right.
Because still,
Jim Wallace,
when Reconstruction was put down,
so Jim Wallace writes about America's original sin being that, and that
Obama has referenced it. I think it's in a sense it's banal to reference it. It's true. But that means, just as my country of birth, I think the result of Brexit, I think it needs something similar. I think it needs a Truth and Reconciliation Committee, because the historical mythology that has allowed people to be so ignorant of themselves and their place in the world, and so just so contemptible towards others, absolutely has to be addressed.
Yeah.
And it's not going to be addressed by politicians who have to make day-to-day decisions that enable them to do not necessarily the best that can be done, but something good that staves off something else. I mean, that's what politicians are for, to help try to make. But the fact is, we've been stuck in grotesque mythologies. Very much the same way as penal substitution theory has been essentially a mythology enabling moralism. So our national myths have enabled all sorts of forms of cruelty to others.
Do you have to develop new myths to replace the old?
Yes, because new myths are simply narrative. And they're narratives that are more truthful. If they're consciously lies, then of course, no, of course you shouldn't do anything else. But what you should be doing is attempting a more truthful account of how we came to be who we are and why our situation is what it is now, and therefore what we should do about it. And that is a very difficult process. It always involves undoing the lies of the previous version, recognizing what, if anything, was true in the previous version, and undoing the lies in certain directions. And the certain direction always has to be in terms towards greater interdependence and towards greater similarity with others. And we are narrative animals. We have to have stories.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And learning how to tell stories that poke the prick the balloon of the previous story is tremendously important. But that doesn't mean that we're left with other than a story afterwards, which won't, in its own term, become what's the word? Susceptible to being rewritten, as it will have to be.
Yeah, there's so many things in our history, in our stories, that we've interpreted in ways that are, I think, really destructive. But one of the calls of the prophets, I think, was the Old Testament prophets was, and I think specifically of Jeremiah, when God calls him and says, your job is to tear down and to build up, and poking holes in the old system, making people aware, letting some light in so that people can see what the system actually is and does. That's a long, slow process. And then building something new on the rubble is also a long, slow process. But it needs to be stuff that we're always doing. Once we get into a mindset of progress means growth and in terms of our personhood and a continual evolving of our beings and our cultures. That's a whole different way of approaching it than, oh, America, we've arrived, we're paradise, we're already there, we just need to preserve that.
The beacon on the hill,
yeah. So that part of the myth alone is massively destructive. And well, anyway,
just dangerous, because there are many ways in which you can be and have been beacons. So it's not a question of undoing the whole thing. It's just a question of making quite sure that the self picture of innocence and goodness doesn't actually make you more dangerous.
Yeah, and which is kind of the history
than the positive things that might come from it. Yeah.
To be measured in your revolution is not an easy thing. We have a weird little issue happening here in our city, having to do with our library, and it's and a county government that is not real supportive of public education and other kinds of things, and I deal with a group of people who are really upset about the incursion of this particular local political leader into spaces where the poor and the disadvantaged can be served. And they have become as militant and violent and narrow in their thinking as the other side. And just how do we balance that and speak the truth, but do it in a kind of love and compassion that I think Jesus, Paul, the New Testament calls us to. But I'll tell you what,
of course, that's not an intellectual thing. Mm-hmm. That's a contemplative thing. How do you stick in the place where you are not in rivalry with either side?
Yeah.
And genuinely not in rivalry. Meaning,
and then nobody wants you.
And nobody wants you. But that's the place from which people can be let go of the easy identity, which is to become a mirror image of your enemy. Mm. That's
exactly what happens. Absolutely. So let me finish by asking you this. You just spoke about it's kind of the contemplative process. How do you talk to folks today in these places where they are exhausted and you're sensing this fatigue with being riled up? How do you talk to people about, and from my perspective, it looks like PTSD in many situations. You're dealing with people who are in the helping professions, pastors and teachers and medical professionals, law enforcement people. It's traumatic for them. What kinds of things do we, where do they find peace? Where do you find peace? And how do we talk to them about finding the strength to carry on in the face of this constant riling and tumult in our world? And truthfully, this just strikes me as I'm sitting here. We're dealing with stuff that previous generations didn't have to deal with, but by and large, we're dealing with the potential for the world to end because of climate change, because of our the amount of weapons of mass destruction that we possess on the planet, because of the number of people on the planet. There's complicating factors that we're dealing with that are relatively new. So where do people turn? Where do you turn?
Well, I have nothing very useful to say on that, since I'm a very poor meditator, very poor contemplative. But I think that a lot of it is to do with learning how to detect the things that are triggering me into self-righteousness, into hatred, into becoming someone by having something right. And saying, let it go. Let it go. Forgive means letting go. Mm. And forgiveness is not a pious thing. Forgiveness is absolutely necessary to survival thing, because it is saying, do not allow yourself to be defined by the evil that is done to you. Let it go. Do not give it free rental space in your head and in your heart. Now, that is very difficult, because that means agreeing to be let off the cheap shot of identity, what I call junk identity, which can be, as you know, exciting and even exhilarating. And it can even find you a new group of friends with whom you're all together, because what you share is a hatred. But that's a cheap shot. Cheap shot identity is. So I think it's those things which we know how to do with dieting.
Speak for yourself on that one. I'm very bad.
Well, no. I'm very bad at it as well. But at least in principle, we know that the idea is that hey, a good steak every now and then is much better than lots of McDonald's.
I just had McDonald's the other day, so.
Oh, I may never talk to you again. Personally, I'm on Team Burger King.
Oh, are you? I'll tell you what. I really enjoyed talking to you, both here and in that.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
And I learn a lot when I talk to folks like you. And I try very hard to ask intelligent questions. And I'm very cool with, I no longer have to win or be impressive. That's a place that I've evolved to. And so when I talk to folks like you, you can just say, nope, that I don't see it that way. I think you're wrong about that. And we can have that conversation. And I think that's a healthy place to be. At least it is for me. And it models for others how we can, in fact, disagree with see different things, share different things, have different stories, but that we can learn from one another and walk together even in the midst of that. And that's part of the solution. That's a long, slow process as well. We have a woman in town here who's trying to put together a group called Walk Me to Paradise or something like that, which is about bringing people together to walk and guiding some conversation as we do that, getting to know one another across differences I'm looking forward to seeing how that pans out, because I think it's an idea whose time has come. Well, enjoy the rest of your sunshiny day in Madrid. And
wonderful.
I'm gonna be having the first 70 degree day of the year.
Oh, very nice. I must now take the dog for his walk and buy him some food.
And not go to McDonald's. We have a Burger King about a mile from here. I walk to that all the time. McDonald's is a much longer trip. I have to take my motorcycle to get there.
Oh, I have McDonald's, Burger King, and Five Guys within 150 yards.
Oh, that's great. I love Five Guys. So, enjoy yourself. Thank you so much for doing
this. Thank you very much indeed.
So that was my conversation with James Allison, one of several conversations I was privileged to have with the leaders of a conference called the Porch Gathering in Asheville, North Carolina, back in March. I hope we gave you something to think about with this one, and I hope you'll come back to Next 2.0 with Marcus Atkinson on a regular basis. Marcus and I and others use this program to talk about the biggest issues facing our community and our democracy, always, but especially in this momentous election year. You can find Next 2.0 with current and archived episodes on all the major streaming platforms every Friday, Spotify, iHeart, Google Play, etc. And also on the fourth Sunday of the month at 4 p.m. on NPR WQLN Erie at 91.3 FM. And lastly, before I get out of here, if you want to comment on this show or any previous ones, if you want to make suggestions for future shows, you can call the Next hotline at 814-240-8816 and leave us a message. Marcus takes those calls very seriously. So
Until next time, this is Chuck Cammarata.